Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
A successful election in Afghanistan, but bombs going off there. And searchers try to confirm pings possibly from the missing Malaysian jet. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Afghanistan's presidential vote is being hailed as a success, with 7 million voters braving Taliban threats to go to the polls. But now there has been an attack. Sharon Bain reports from Kabul.
While the voting is over, the election process is not. Allegations of fraud have begun to come in, and the Taliban on Sunday attacked a convoy carrying boxes full of ballots to be counted. Election workers were killed and the boxes destroyed. Andrew Wilder of the United States Institute of Peace says officials need to thoroughly investigate all claims of fraud, or the election will risk losing credibility in the eyes of the people.
There are areas where there probably was significant levels of fraud. Given the turnout figures, we'd be surprised if the fraud was at such a decisive level that it would have a major impact on the outcome.
If successful, Saturday's election will be Afghanistan's first democratic transfer of power from one elected leader to another. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Kabul.
The head of the U.S. Defense Department says Washington plans to send two more missile defense warships to Japan to counter the threat posed by North Korea's actions. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel addressed the media in Tokyo today after meeting with his Japanese counterpart.
In response to Pyongyang's pattern of provocative and destabilizing actions, including recent missile launches in violation of UN Security Council resolutions, I can announce today that the United States is planning to forward deploy two additional Aegis ballistic missile defense ships to Japan by 2017.
The announcement came as North Korea once again ratcheted up the tensions with its neighbors by continuing to threaten additional missile and nuclear tests. U.S., Israeli, and Palestinian negotiators are expected to resume talks today aimed at working toward a Middle East peace agreement. On Saturday, Israel's chief negotiator in the talks said the talks need to continue in spite of the difficulty up to this point. That request came just one day after U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the Obama administration is reevaluating its role in the Middle East peace process, after moves by both Israel and the Palestinians that caused the talks to collapse. Israel failed to release a group of Palestinian prisoners, and Palestinian leadership reneged on a promise not to seek accession to more than a dozen international conventions during the talks. Authorities coordinating the international search from Australia for a missing Malaysia Airlines passenger jet say underwater signals have been heard three times since Friday. The transmissions could be from the aircraft's data and voice recorders. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
Australian, Chinese, and Malaysian officials are cautioning that reports from ships of underwater signals in the Indian Ocean do not mean that the location of Flight 370 has been determined. In Perth, Australia, the search's chief coordinator, Angus Houston, tells reporters nothing is yet verified.
This is an important and encouraging lead, but one which I urge you to continue to treat carefully.
The potential breakthrough, however, the retired Australian Air Force chief confirms, is prompting the diversion of ships and planes to the area where the Chinese patrol vessel, Haishun 1, detected acoustic pulses on Friday and Saturday in waters up to 4.5 kilometers deep. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is urging leaders of the troubled Central African Republic to heed the lessons of Rwanda and do more to stop ethnic violence. The CAR has seen sectarian violence that has killed thousands of people and forced most of the Muslim minority to flee the country. Mr. Ban visited the CAR's capital, Bangui, Saturday on his way to Rwanda for a memorial to the 800,000 victims of genocide in 1994. Voting is underway in Hungary in a parliamentary election sure to give Prime Minister Viktor Orban another 4 years in office. Mr. Orban is credited by many voters for improving the economy and lowering utility costs after 8 years of social mismanagement. Costa Rica is also voting for a new president, although the outcome is, again, not in doubt. Sunday is the runoff of the Central American nation's presidential election. Former diplomat Luis Guillermo Solis is set to become the first third-party candidate to win the Costa Rican presidency in decades. His opponent, Johnny Araya of the ruling National Liberation Party, dropped out of the race after Solis' popularity skyrocketed after the first round of the vote. I'm Marty Johnson, VOA News in Washington. More news at voanews.com.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
That official France in the early 90s, all the way to the time of the genocide, wronged this country is a fact.
Rwanda blames France again of role in 1994 genocide.
What's critical is to understand if there is this collusion, to understand whether it's a collusion born of corruption, born of desperation simply to avoid combat that would result in casualties for the men under your command, or if it's born of ideological sympathy with the insurgents.
A Nigerian soldier accuses some of the country's military commanders of working with Boko Haram militants.
La communauté internationale a fait défaut au Rwandais il y a 20 ans et nous risquons.
Mr. Ban said the international community failed the people of Rwanda 20 years ago and is at risk of not doing enough for the people of the CAR today.
And UN Secretary General makes a whirlwind trip to the Central African Republic. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
Rwanda's foreign minister has reasserted claims France had a role in the 1994 Rwandan genocide after French diplomats pulled out of genocide memorial events in response to the accusations. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports the dispute comes as Rwanda prepares to host world leaders for commemoration of the 20th anniversary of the atrocity.
At an international forum on genocide being held Sunday in Kigali, Foreign Minister Louise Mushikiwabo stood by Rwandan President Paul Kagame's remarks, implying the French government played a direct role in the preparation and execution of the genocide.
That official France in the early 90s, all the way to the time of the genocide, wronged this country is a fact.
Mr. Kagame's remarks to the African news weekly Jeune Afrique prompted France to withdraw a delegation due to attend genocide memorial events this week in Kigali. French Foreign Affairs spokesman Romain Nadal told VOA his government was surprised by Mr. Kagame's declarations, saying they go against the ongoing process of reconciliation between the two countries. Relations between France and Rwanda deteriorated after the genocide due to accusations that France had supported ethnic Hutu militias responsible for killing nearly 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus in a span of 100 days. While France has denied any role in the slaughter, Mushikiwabo said relations cannot be repaired if Rwanda has to accept the French version of events.
It will become impossible for our two countries to move forward if the condition is that Rwanda has to forgo its history in order to get along with France.
Kigali will host officials from across the world this week for ceremonies commemorating the 20th anniversary of the genocide. In an opinion article timed for the anniversary, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged the international community to learn from its failure to stop the genocide in Rwanda and to take stronger action to confront modern-day crises like the conflict in the Central African Republic. The international community, he said, cannot claim to care about atrocity crimes and then shrink from the commitment of resources and will required to actually prevent them. At a ceremony in Kigali Monday, Rwanda's President Kagame will light a national flame of mourning that will burn for 100 days. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kigali.
Each April, Rwanda and some other African countries pay homage to victims of the 1994 genocide. Those countries include Kenya, which has also had its share of political volatility and intertribal fighting, especially after the 2007 presidential election. Since then, Kenya has made progress in building credible government institutions. But as Mohammed Yusuf reports for VOA, some analysts and activists are warning those gains are fragile.
Kenya's disputed presidential election in 2007 revealed how dangerous ethnic divisions and corruption can be to the country's citizens. Since then, the international community has pushed the country's leaders to implement political, police and judicial reforms in order to avoid a return to violence. Political analyst Adam Olo, a lecturer at the University of Nairobi, says Kenya must learn how to let institutions work without interference.
Kenya has also had its own lessons of the 2007-2008 post-election violence. And I think that what Kenya needs to learn is that basically institutions should work for the good of the country. I think Kenya did very well by coming up with a new constitution.
In 2010, more than 60% of voters approved a new Kenyan constitution to replace one that many saw as causing institutional weakness, in effect enabling the violence. The new constitution created a Supreme Court and set new procedures for appointing top officials in the government like judges and police. Late in 2012, a survey showed more than 80% of Kenyans had confidence in the courts. This confidence prompted the losing presidential candidate in that year's election, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, to challenge the result in the Supreme Court, rather than calling for mass protest. The head of the group Inuka All Stand Up Kenya is John Githongo. He says some politicians are fighting the recent changes and warns the recent gains for democracy and rule of law could be erased.
The most important instrument for peace and continued and harmonious life in Kenya is the constitution. And one of the disturbing things that we're seeing is very determined efforts to roll back some of the victories that have been won as a result of the new constitution.
Githonga says the constitution is the primary instrument for holding his countrymen together in a peaceful future. Political analyst Olo says if people lose faith in the new institutions, the country may witness violence.
To the extent that people lose confidence in the institutions that are supposed to ensure harmony or to pretend of conflictual issues or dispute resolution.
President Uhuru Kenyatta and Deputy William Ruto are facing charges at the International Criminal Court. They helped to orchestrate the post-election violence. But the case against Mr. Kenyatta is on the verge of falling apart. A former anti-corruption campaigner, Githongo, notes the president and Ruto formed their alliance in part to fight the ICC and suggests things may change if the Kenyatta case is dropped.
Of course, one is forced to ask the question, if one of the main rationales that underlay this coalition is collapsing, then obviously there shall be realignment, and one hopes that those realignments can happen in a peaceful manner.
But Githongo doubts that will happen. He says the nature of Kenyan politics is that change is usually accompanied by some sort of violence. Mohammed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon is in Kigali Sunday to mark the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. During a stop in the Central African Republic, he said the international community must do more and act more quickly. Intercommunal violence in CAR has killed more than 2,000 people since December and displaced an additional 800,000. VOA's Anne Luke was with the Secretary-General in Bangui during his visit.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told the CAR's acting parliament, the National Transition Council, that their country is in, quote, a state of anarchy.
La communauté internationale a fait défaut au Rwanda il y a 20 ans. Et nous risquons...
Mr. Ban said the international community failed the people of Rwanda 20 years ago and is at risk of not doing enough for the people of the CAR today. The UN leader noted that atrocious crimes are being committed in the CAR, including lynchings, decapitations, and sexual violence. He told the council that ethno-religious cleansing is a reality and that Muslims and Christians have been placed in mortal danger simply because of who they are or what they believe. The Secretary General commended the efforts of French and African Union troops here, but said they are, quote, under-resourced and overwhelmed by what he called the sheer scale of the need. Mr. Ban said he continues to push for transforming the AU troops here into a UN peacekeeping force that would include 10,000 soldiers and about 2,000 police. During his whirlwind visit to Bangui, the Secretary General greeted displaced persons outside the camp at the airport. It's a staggering makeshift patchwork of shelters, home to about 60,000 people. Many have been there since December 5th, when heavy fighting and intercommunal killing broke out in the capital. A representative of the displaced persons at the camp told the Secretary General they are not there waiting for handouts. He says they want to go home, but many homes were looted or destroyed, and their neighborhoods are not safe. He said disarmament is the solution. The Secretary General also visited the central mosque in the PK5 neighborhood, where approximately 10,000 Muslim civilians remain trapped. Anti-Balaka militia outside are a daily threat, despite international troops on the perimeter. At the mosque, they held up signs saying they want to be evacuated. There were several signs calling for the division of the country, a growing concern here as the Muslim minority flees to relative safety in the northeast, a zone still under the control of the mostly Muslim Exelica rebels. An imam at the mosque read the Secretary General a dark inventory of what they have suffered since December. The murders, the threats, the destruction of their homes, businesses, and mosques. Ban Ki-moon spoke to the Muslims of Bangui. He says he is, quote, saddened by what he has seen. Your life, he says, is very difficult and very dangerous. Human rights, he said, is top priority, and he has deployed UN investigators to the CAR. Mr. Ban had the same message here as at every stop. You can count on me, he said. The international community will not fail you. The UN Security Council could vote on establishing a UN peacekeeping force for the CAR in a matter of days. And Mr. Ban said he is pushing for, quote, decisive action. However, analysts say a UN force would likely not be able to deploy until at least September. And look, VOA News, Bangui.
A Nigerian soldier says he has witnessed incidents that suggest some of the country's military commanders are working together with Boko Haram, an Islamist militant group blamed for thousands of deaths since 2009. The soldier gave his account to VOA's Hausa service. Pam Duckins has the story.
This soldier from a unit in northeastern Nigeria says he wants the world to know that some Nigerian army commanders are facilitating the deaths of their soldiers one by one. The soldier, who does not want to be identified, told us his unit recently walked into a Boko Haram ambush after traveling to the town of Bama to assist another Nigerian military unit. The two units went back into the field together, the soldier said, but members of the team from Bama abruptly withdrew as the first group of soldiers carrying only light weapons came up to the ambush site. The troops from Bama, who had armored vehicles with them, left without firing a shot as Boko Haram snipers in the surrounding forest began picking off the first group of soldiers one by one. The soldier told us that he and his comrades recognized some of the Boko Haram marksmen as former Nigerian army trainers who they had met at a base near Abuja, the capital. He told VOA his group realized they were being fired on by some turncoat mercenaries. Nigerian authorities have refused repeated requests to discuss the anonymous soldier's allegations, but some analysts of the protracted conflict in northern Nigeria say the charges could have merit. Peter Pham, director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, says of the soldiers' account of collaboration between the army and Boko Haram,
it certainly would not surprise me that it's happening.
But he adds the task is now to figure out how and why this happens.
What's critical is to understand if there is this collusion, to understand whether it's a collusion born of corruption, born of desperation simply to avoid combat that would result in casualties for the men under your command, or if it's born of ideological sympathy with the insurgents.
2 years ago, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan charged in a speech that Boko Haram members had infiltrated his government's executive, legislative, and judicial sectors, the police, and the nation's armed forces. He has declared a state of emergency in three northern regions where Boko Haram is active and launched operations to destroy the group's camps. Despite the efforts, large-scale attacks have continued. E.J. Hogendorn of the International Crisis Group says systemic corruption is a broad problem for Nigeria. In his view, drivers such as bad governance and state institutions' inability to provide basic services help create a pool of unemployed youth who are ripe for radicalization.
We argue that even were Boko Haram to be defeated, if you don't deal with those drivers, you are not going to be able to stabilize either northern Nigeria or the entire country.
Hogendorn and other analysts say that if Nigeria is to eradicate such disturbing practices as collaboration between military units and terror groups, the national government must address corruption and poor governance in a systematic and sustained way. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Washington.
Guinea-worm disease and river blindness are among 17 tropical diseases the World Health Organization considers neglected, thanks to the efforts of the Atlanta-based Carter Center, founded by former President Jimmy Carter and his wife Rosalynn. Focused treatment and prevention are leading to the elimination of one and the extinction of another. VOA's Ken Faraba talked with the former president about progress in fighting these neglected diseases.
When former President Jimmy Carter and the Carter Center staff started working to eradicate guinea worm disease in 1986, it was found in 21 countries in Africa and Asia.
But we had 3.5 million cases of guinea worm, and village by village we've done away with it, and last year we only had 146 cases in the whole world.
Most of the remaining infections by the parasitic worm are found in South Sudan, where Mr. Carter says, despite the recent unrest, the Carter Center continues working to prevent transmission of the disease by monitoring and filtering water sources.
So it's a big operation still. At this moment, I think we have about 212 people on our payroll, almost all of whom have been trained locally, and about 8,000 women who volunteer their services.
Elsewhere in Africa, the Carter Center has shifted its focus from controlling river blindness, another parasitic infection, to eliminating it. While river blindness can't be eradicated like guinea worm, the Carter Center discovered that by modifying the dosage of the antibiotic ivermectin,
she gets three tablets.
It could be eliminated in the human body.
And we found out eventually that instead of just controlling the disease, we had to give a pill every year. If we gave 2 to 4 pills a year, then the adult worms that created the microbe filaria would be eliminated. So we found out that in Latin America and 6 countries, we could completely do away with river blindness permanently. And now we've tried that in Africa and found it to be successful again.
The World Health Organization reports about 18 million people worldwide suffer from river blindness, 99% of them in Africa.
It can be so itchy that these patients can itch their skin so much that part of their skin actually goes white. And then there's a huge stigma still in some parts of Africa of associating some parts of skin going white with leprosy.
Dr. Aisha Sethi is an assistant professor of infectious diseases at the University of Chicago Medical Center. She says river blindness, which is the second leading cause of preventable blindness by infection, hurts both people and the economy.
You see, the more people that are poor and are sick and you're losing the working capacity of that country. You're losing the money that family is making towards treatment of that person.
Dr. Sethi is originally from Pakistan, one of the first countries where the Carter Center eradicated guinea worm. As she works on a field manual about neglected tropical diseases she hopes to publish in a few years, one uncertainty about the book is how to represent guinea worm.
I don't know if we'll have guinea worm in there except as a historic perspective. Maybe by the time the book comes out, we might be down to zero cases.
Zero cases is the goal of the Carter Center and an achievement that former President Carter, who turns 90 in October, is confident he will witness in his lifetime. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
Hello, I'm Lenore Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Meanwhile, in Mali, the government has resigned and town planning minister Moussa Mara will become prime minister, according to a presidential spokesman who appeared on state television late Saturday. Mara had been asked to form a new government. The statement said President Ibrahim Boukpa Keita ended the duties of Prime Minister Omar Tamale after the government resigned. No reason was given for the government's decision. President Keita was elected last August on a pledge to unite Mali and is seeking to rebuild the nation after a coup and a rebellion by Islamists. You're listening to Nightline Africa, coming to you live from Washington.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
Together we host the Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
VOA Africa Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
You're listening to The Voice of America, and this is Nightline Africa. This is Nightline Africa, coming to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.
And coming up in the second half of the program, shall have sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, music from African Collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation.
And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
But let's start with Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos and join Segun on the dot at DMA. Take it away, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, April 6th. Let's blast off with athletics. Expectations were high for the Prague Half Marathon on Saturday, especially in the women's race, where the Kenyan Joyce Chepkirui was talking about attacking the world record. Andy Edwards reports from the Czech capital on the outcome.
Joyce Chepkirui produced a highly impressive performance. Not quite the world record she had talked about, but the fifth fastest of all time and a course record in Prague. The men's race was also dramatic as fellow Kenyan Peter Kirui broke the hour and set a personal best on his return to top-flight competition. Conditions were good for the midday start with a temperature around 16 degrees centigrade and little wind. Joyce Chepkirui went off hard and fast, perhaps too fast, because she was on world record pace the first 10 kilometres. Emily Chibet was her main challenger, but the double world cross-country champion was adrift by the early stages. Although Chepkirui slowed towards the end, she maintained a pace of under 66 minutes for much of this race on a course which is far from easy. Prague has sections of cobblestones which pose difficulties, so Chepkirui could well threaten the world record of her training partner, Florence Kiplagat, one day. Chepkirui won in 66 minutes and 19 seconds, with Emily Chibet just over half a minute behind, and Ethiopia's Wude Ayalu third, more than 3 minutes adrift of the winner. Chepkirui's performance was 29 seconds faster than that of Gladys Chirono last year, and she went on to win the world title at the distance last month. Peter Kirui said later he didn't feel good for the early stages of the men's race, but certainly turned on the power to surge away from the lead group at around 13 kilometres. He built on that lead, looking very impressive for a runner who professed to be short of full training after undergoing a year-long course at Nairobi's Police Academy. He won in 59 minutes 22, around half a minute outside the men's course record, but the fastest half marathon of his career. This return to competition bodes well for Kirui's future. Second place went to the Ethiopian Mozinet Gereme, just over half a minute down, and Daniel Wanjiru of Kenya, no relation to the late great Sammy, was third, finishing 1 second inside the hour. All three men set personal bests. There were many smiling faces among the successful runners, but none more so than Joyce Chepkirui, who wins €34,000 thanks to various time bonuses. That's the news in Prague, Segun. Now back to you in Lagos.
Thank you for that report, Andy. After the race, Andy sat down with the women's winner of the Prague Half Marathon, Joyce Chepkirui. Here is the interview.
We're talking with the winner of the women's title at the Sportissimo Prague Half Marathon 2014, and that is Joyce Chepkirui of Kenya, and she's broken the course record with 66 minutes 19. Very fast time indeed. Joyce, you really looked hungry to run not only a course record, but at some stage early in the race, you were on world record pace. Did you feel that confident?
Yeah, today I'm feeling very happy because I've run here again my first time, 66.19. So I'm happy so much.
When you were on world record pace, did you have the thought, well, I'm going too fast?
Yeah, I think from first kilometer to 18 kilometer, I was under world record. But from I think 19 kilometer to 20, it was very tough for me because it was early.
You were running on your own. Emily Chibet of Kenya was quite some way back. But Prague is not an easy course, is there? I mean, just looking at it, you've got cobblestones. It's not the easiest of half marathon courses.
Yeah, but I think it's not a bad course. But I think maybe next year
I have to come back again. I know I have a world record in my body.
That was the women's winner of the Prague Half Marathon, Joyce Chepkirui, speaking with Andy Edwards after the race in the Czech capital on Saturday. Turning to football news, the 2014 FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup has ended in Costa Rica, and the winner is Japan. Japan beat Spain 2-0 in the final on Friday to lift its first FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup crown. Goals at either end of the final gave Japan victory. The Asians were remarkable at the tournament, winning all their 7 matches. Earlier, Italy finished in third place on penalties, following an action-packed 4-4 encounter against Venezuela. Venezuela remarkably equalized on 4 occasions, including a last-second goal from defender Sandra Luzzatto, only for Italy to prevail 2-0 on penalties. 2 of Africa's 3 representatives at the tournament, Ghana and Nigeria, were eliminated in the quarterfinal stage. The third African team, Zambia, failed to progress beyond the group phase. A record number of supporters, 268,896, attended matches at Costa Rica 2014 at an average of 8,403 fans per match, surpassing the previous mark set at Azerbaijan 2012. Staying with football, today's Sunday is being marked globally as the first International Day of Sport for Development and Peace. President Sepp Blatter of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, speaks on the day.
Sunday, the 6th of April 2014, marks the first United Nations International Day of Sport for Development and Peace, a day that commemorates the contribution of sport to education, human development, healthy lifestyles, and a peaceful world. FIFA and myself firmly believe in the power of football to inspire people, build bridges, and change lives. Indeed, the first of our statutory objectives is to constantly improve the game of football, promoting it globally in the light of its unifying educational, cultural, and humanitarian values, particularly through youth and development programs. Our sport has a truly global reach and offers unparalleled opportunities to communicate with people from all nations and backgrounds across the world, and demonstrates that even in the most difficult settings, such as Afghanistan or Somalia, football can bring hope.
That was FIFA President Sepp Blatter speaking on the first International Day of Sports for Development and Peace, being observed around the world today, Sunday. Many thanks to FIFA.com for the audio. Now to our weekly World Cup countdown. It is now 67 days to the kickoff of the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil, and the countdown continues. FIFA Secretary General Jerome Volpe has made a brutally honest assessment of Brazil's World Cup preparations. "If you want me to summarize, we are not ready," he told the Associated Press news agency at a conference in South Africa this past week. Volpe's comments come as 2 stadiums, the Itaquerão in Sao Paulo and the Estadio Beira-Rio in Porto Alegre, remain unfinished. Work at the Itaquerão has been delayed because of 3 construction deaths, the latest of which came last weekend. The 68,000-seat stadium is supposed to host the opening match between Brazil and Croatia on June 12th. It was scheduled to be finished in mid-April, but FIFA admits there is no way it will open before May 15. Construction work in Porto Alegre will also come down to the wire. And from Rio comes the report that more than 2,000 Brazilian soldiers stormed the city's shantytown on Saturday with armored personnel carriers and helicopters in a bid to improve security ahead of the World Cup. As dawn broke, the heavily armed soldiers entered the sprawling mayor shantytown, which has been ruled over by drug gangs for years. The occupation of Mea, which is controlled by 2 rival drug gangs and a militia, began last week when more than 1,000 police officers and marines entered the shantytown. No shots were fired during the first phase of the shantytown's takeover. The occupation is part of the government's strategy to take over some of Rio's more than 1,000 slums before Brazil plays host to the World Cup as well as the 2016 Olympics. Now, with the World Cup celebrations just on the horizon, sportswear company Adidas is sending Brazuca, the official ball of the tournament, on a worldwide trip. This is not any old Brazuca ball, however. This one is special and packed with cameras to give fans a panoramic view of life as a soccer ball. Meanwhile, Brazil's 22-year-old star, Neymar, says he has butterflies in his stomach just thinking of the 2014 FIFA World Cup. He says his excitement at the prospect of representing his country on the game's grandest stage is almost overwhelming. I think it is an honor to wear the Brazil shirt in my country and to see my greatest childhood dream come true, Neymar says. This will be Neymar's first World Cup. His country, Brazil, has been drawn in the same group as Croatia, Cameroon, and Mexico at the tournament. Back here in Africa, Asamoah Gyan, captain of Ghana's national team, says expectations are very high for his team at the World Cup. Gyan says the entire nation expects an improvement on the team's quarterfinal finish in the previous competition 4 years ago. But he admits that the challenge is tough, considering the equally tough group in which Ghana is drawn. The Black Stars face Germany, the United States, and Portugal in the first phase. With 4 goals in 8 games at the World Cup to his credit, Jan believes that past experiences will put them in good stead to manage their group, which has been described as the group of death. We've got a lot of experience in the World Cup. We are going to make sure we make every Ghanaian proud by playing a normal game, and we'll see what happens, Jan says. Finally, Ivory Coast striker Haruna Kone is doubtful for the World Cup in Brazil following an injury. Kone, who plays for English Premiership club Everton, has been sidelined since October and required an operation to fix a cartilage problem in his knee. Ivory Coast, one of Africa's 5 teams at the World Cup, has been drawn in Group C alongside Colombia, Greece, and Japan. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Mpuga.
Thanks a lot, Segun. Segun on the Dota DM will be back again next Sunday for another look at Afghan sports right here on Nightline Africa.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa and time for music from the continent. Enjoy.
mwate Zela nanga iya bomoi Keke ibamba Motema moto moto Mabala ya bomwana Pele ki makambo Pampa sinako mona Nale biko botela Motema pe mabanzo Kako pesa mokongo Na memingambo Mabala ya bomwana Pele ki makambo Sansa Oyangana yo Oyangana yo Oyangana yo Eko mingana mela poisson Oyangana yo Oyangana yo Oyangana yo Nyako konya
Yes, that was Nyako Konya by Orchestra Mangalepa. That was our music Sunday spot here at Nightline Africa, here at the service of the Voice of America.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Despite the collective efforts of the global community, the situation in the Central African Republic, CAR, remains unstable, and the lives of its people continue to be nasty, brutish, and short. The turmoil began across the country when, just over a year ago, March 24, 2013, to be precise, a coalition of the Seleka, mostly Muslims from the northeast of the country and others from Chad and the Sudan, overthrew the government of President François Bozizé in a military coup. Since then, chaos has descended on the country. The Seleka rebels unleashed a reign of terror in the country, and the victims were mostly Christians. In revenge, it was reported that a predominant Christian and animist fighters, known now as the anti-Baleka fighters, has applied tremendous pressure on the Seleka. By the way, the anti-Baleka means anti-machete. The success of the anti-Baleka made it necessary for the Seleka's leader to accept defeat and went into exile. As a result of mediation efforts, Madame Catherine Saniba Panza, the former mayor of the capital, Bangui, was elected the new leader of an interim government with a mandate to prepare fresh elections. Although she immediately promised to stop the mayhem in the country and promote security, she has not been able to achieve her goal. Instead, the instability has persisted, and now, on the basis of many reports, it is the Christians' anti-Balaka group that is committing serious crimes against the Muslim population. The anti-Balaka fighters have demanded that all the Muslims be removed from the diamond mining towns, and it appears that the Muslims are prepared to leave. Many have already left the CAR and gone to neighboring countries as refugees. With the aim of stabilizing the situation and restoring peace, the African Union has deployed 6,000 troops in a peacekeeping operation. In addition, France, the former colonial power, has deployed 2,000 mobile forces. But some experts believe that in a country as large as France, the total force is insufficient. The anti-Balaka fighters have little respect for the peacekeeping forces, and in some cases, they have been attacked. That is why the peacekeeping forces now consider the anti-Balaka the enemy. Last February, there were discussions that the European Union would also deploy some troops. However, it was only last Thursday that the European Union announced that it had commenced the deployment of 1,000 troops for a six-month period. Germany would not be contributing troops, but might provide logistics support. Even the addition of the European troops may not help much. That may explain why Human Rights Watch, a non-state actor, has formally recommended that a United Nations peacekeeping operation be deployed. The idea was discussed last weekend at United Nations headquarters, and many Africans are skeptical about this. The reason being that the command and control of peacekeeping forces on behalf of the Secretary General resides in the Department of Peacekeeping Operation that is headed by a French national. Africans have very minimal influence in that department. The African troops in the CAR are able to accomplish the task if they are given sufficient financing and adequate logistics, but these are not forthcoming from the United Nations. Last week, matters became complicated when Mali, angered by accusation that it was favoring the Muslims in the CAR, decided to withdraw its 800-man contingent. However, the situation in the Central African Republic remains unstable and critical. There is also greater urgency to stop the killings. The international community has the obligation to make certain and use its best efforts to ensure that the CAR is not cited as yet another example where Christians are killing Muslims. I thank you.
That was a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thanks for joining us tonight. I hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
And hope you'll join us again on Saturday. I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The threat of nuclear terrorism is real and remains one of the greatest threats to global security. An act of nuclear terrorism would have grave repercussions around the world, including the potential for a dramatic loss of life, the spread of radiation, and damage to the international economy. The best way to prevent terrorists from acquiring a nuclear weapon is to prevent them from accessing the nuclear material needed to build one. To promote efforts to prevent nuclear terrorism, President Barack Obama convened the first Nuclear Security Summit in Washington in 2010. 47 countries from every region of the world committed to safeguard nuclear materials from loss or theft. Since then, the world has made substantial progress. Subsequent nuclear security summits were convened in Seoul in 2012 and The Hague in 2014. Individual countries have taken specific actions to secure nuclear materials in their countries and to prevent illicit trafficking and smuggling. Indeed, since President Obama's first major national security speech in Prague in 2009 on nuclear security, 12 countries have completely eliminated highly enriched uranium from within their borders, and 24 highly enriched uranium nuclear reactors in 14 countries were successfully converted to low-enriched uranium fuel use or verified as shut down. In total, 27 countries have removed or disposed of nearly 3,000 kilograms of highly enriched uranium and separated plutonium. With its allies and partners, the United States will continue to work to put in place a sustainable global nuclear security architecture designed to reduce the threat of nuclear terrorism, including at the next Nuclear Security Summit to be held in the United States in 2016.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.